Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, the 5 mile an hour difference. Vision Zero activists were up in Albany yesterday lobbying for a law that would reduce New York City's official speed limit to 20 miles an hour on local streets. Now, Mayor de Blasio already wants to lower it, but only to 25 miles an hour. We'll talk to 20 MPH advocate Mary Beth Kelly today about the 5 mile an hour difference and why she wants us to stop referring to car crashes as accidents. Also today, the U.S. government's first ever chief technology officer, Anish Chopra, now gone from that job in the Obama administration. We'll talk about transparency and digital democracy, more of a struggle under Obama than many people expected. And we'll introduce phase two today of WNYC's Clock Your Sleep project. We'll meet the leaders of three sleep teams, well-known WNYC hosts, taking different approaches to getting more Z's, and we'll tell you how you can pick a team and join the experiment. But we begin today with the latest on Bridgegate and the exposed political rut at the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Who decided it was time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee? Not Bridget Ann Kelly, who wrote the famous email saying that it was. At least that was the testimony at a state legislature hearing yesterday from Christina Renna, who worked directly under Bridget Ann Kelly. So let's get our latest Bridgegate update with our Christie administration correspondent, Matt Katz, and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, our official, she knows everything about the Port Authority correspondent. Hi, Andrea. Hi, Matt.
Good morning.
Hi, Brian.
So here is a clip of Renna yesterday revealing that she knew while the bridge closure, the lane closures were going on, that the mayor of Fort Lee, Mark Sokolich, was unhappy. He complained about the problem and about the public safety threat from emergency vehicles not being able to get through. He emailed Christina Renna. Renna did not pass that email to her superiors, and here she says why.
10 days later, you get this odd phone call at night, and you're asked to destroy evidence, basically. I know you said it was odd. Did you think that it was slightly illegal?
The answer is I was scared of overstepping over Bridget. This is a very severe implication. If I ended up being wrong, I thought I would lose my job. You know, I didn't want to, you know, if I went to counsel's office with the email, I have no doubt that whoever that was in counsel's office would go to Bridget Kelly and say, why does, you know, Christina Renna want 5 minutes with me? Just because a lot of people, especially in counsel's office, didn't know me very well. So I was fearful. I was fearful of getting her caught up in something that I didn't know if she was involved in it or not. And I was scared of, you know, if it ended up being false, violating her trust and never being able to get that back. I mean, there's a lot of things that went into it, so.
Christina Renna, who worked for Bridget Ann Kelly, testifying before a state legislature committee investigating Bridgegate yesterday. Matt Katz, put that exchange in perspective for us.
Sure. So while the lanes are closed, Mark Sokolich, the mayor of Fort Lee, is freaking out. He says this is a public emergency. I don't know why this is happening. Can someone help me? And this email from him lands on this message from him lands on Christina Renna's desk. She's a regional director. She's in charge of interfacing with local officials. And she forwards it to Bridget Ann Kelly. And Bridget Kelly says, good. And Christina Renna testified yesterday. She didn't know what that meant, but she does know that 3 months later, while when Bridgegate is starting to escalate and there are a lot of questions and the upper senior staff of Christie's office is getting very concerned about what this means for the governor, Renna gets a call from Kelly and says, remember that email I sent you, the one that says good, delete that. So Christina Renna, she said yesterday that this seemed strange and odd. So she ended up deleting it, but she forwarded a copy to her personal account and saved it for herself. Now, the other unusual and interesting thing about this is that Bridget Kelly actually showed part of this email exchange to Governor Christie's lawyer, to his counsel back in December. She showed him an email that said that Rena had forwarded her this concern from the mayor. She just didn't include the good exchange. But what raised the more questions yesterday is, so Christie's counsel and Christie himself knew that Sokolich was complaining and that Rena got this message and that Rena was aware of all this concern about the lane closures, but nobody asked Rena about it. Nobody from Christie's office tried to get more information about this email exchange that they had gotten part of from Bridget Kelly. So, you know, yesterday after 5 hours of testimony, we're sort of left with more questions about why there wasn't more concern about this major issue that was bubbling up over several months.
And maybe the most tantalizing part of Rena's testimony in those 5 hours yesterday was that she said she thinks Bridget Ann Kelly did not decide herself to order the gridlock on the bridge, and that she, Rena, has an educated guess about who did, but she didn't actually speak that name, did she?
She did not, and the Democrats, for whatever reason, did not press her on it. But she did give something of a hint. She said many times that Bridget Kelly was not the type of supervisor who would make decisions on her own. Rena described her as not having a lot of self-esteem, so she would need approval from elsewhere, which insinuates that she had to get approval from somebody above her in the governor's office in order to make a decision like causing traffic problems in Fort Lee.
That was really interesting, her characterization of Bridget Ann Kelly like that, saying that Kelly would frequently say she would check with the governor's office before answering questions that lawmakers had. Lawmakers back that up, that Kelly was not a decision maker, that she's someone who asked for guidance a lot. I think Rena used that phrase. But you know, Matt, after Governor Christie fired Kelly for sending that email, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, he called her the architect of the lane closures. He used that word architect, and it strikes me that it's the same word that President Bush used to use for Karl Rove. When Rove was making Bush's big political decisions and running his campaigns, he called Rove the architect. But it seems increasingly clear that Bridget Ann Kelly was not the Karl Rove of Bridgegate, so the plot thickens.
I think it does. I mean, next week we've got Christie's spokesman who's coming in for testimony, and he's known to have volatile exchanges with reporters, so it'll be interesting if there are more fireworks. I don't know if he, though, is going to be able to tell us who ordered it. He's going to provide more information, perhaps, about how it was handled and the damage control and the potential cover-up after the fact. But In a sense, whoever might have spoken to Bridget Kelly right before she sent that time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee email, that question is almost as unanswered as it was when all of this came out January 8th. It's remarkable.
Another question is about the whole relationship between Bridget Ann Kelly, who was not a political operative of the governor officially. She was his deputy chief of staff. There's supposed to be a distinction, a bright line, in any political campaign of an incumbent between the people who are working for that elected official in office and those who are working on a campaign with private funding, not taxpayer funding. But Rena was asked whether there was crossover between, say, doing business with Fort Lee on some kind of state business and looking for an endorsement from the mayor. Here's 14 seconds of her response.
It was your understanding their job was to secure endorsements.
It was not their job to secure endorsements.
One of their functions.
If they felt an opportunity to secure an endorsement and were comfortable doing so, they were given the green light to do that, yes.
So she was trying to say no there, but she did then say what we just heard. If they felt an opportunity to secure an endorsement and were comfortable doing so, they were given the green light to do that, yes. What does that reveal?
That they were playing very close to the line. I mean, these guys were supposed to be only getting endorsements after hours, but they were also dealing with these same mayors during hours. And we know for a fact that there were endorsement conversations happening during the day, during the week. Now, were these employees, did they call in sick that day? Were they using a vacation time? I don't know, but they were playing very close to the line. There were pieces of paper, there were reports that were issued where they had to say which Democrats they were targeting. And it said it had their title. They were in the IGA unit and of the governor's office. And it would say IGA staffer, colon, and then the name, and then the Democratic target. So it would essentially say governmental employee, colon, you know, Matt Katz, Brian Lehr, and then political target, you know, the mayor of Fort Lee.
Hey, don't get me involved in this. But Andrea Bernstein, you've been covering politics for a long time. This playing close to the line between official business and political campaigning, this would be how unusual among elected officials?
Unusual. Usually,
really?
Yes, absolutely. Usually there's somebody like the press secretary who's sort of like a political person and maybe one other person. So that might have been Bill Stepien. It might have been Bridget Kelly. This was through the whole office. And Christina Renna, even while I think she was trying to clean up some of the things that she was reported to have said in the Master Report, for example, the Master Report quoted her as saying there was a mandatory directive not to call people back. And she said, well, I didn't use the words mandatory directive. And then she said,
this is just to be clear. The Master Report is Governor Christie's own internal investigation of what happened with Bridgegate. And when you say Christina Renna yesterday tried to clean it up, you mean she tried to put a better spin on
exactly.
some of the things that were reported?
Right. And she tried to put a better spin on what a lot of people think is already spin. But even in doing this, she acknowledged, well, we weren't proactive in reaching out to them if they hadn't endorsed us, and that they kept these Google spreadsheets with all kinds of information, including whether they'd endorsed.
In other words, they were punishing Democratic mayors around the state of New Jersey if they declined to endorse Christie for re-election.
Well, she said by not being proactive. I mean, you know, what she said is we were sort of above and beyond helpful in the normal course of business, and maybe we wouldn't be so above and beyond, but of course we would help them with their problems, but when she testified about what she did with Sokolich, it was not that. They didn't help him with his problems. He had a big problem. So this was
he had a big problem.
September 12th.
He sent an email.
Right. September 12th, he calls.
Talked about public safety, emergency vehicles.
First responders. This is a known terror target. It's the busiest bridge in the country. He says first responders are stuck. And they never called him back to help him with his problem. So they didn't even.
And she sat on the email and didn't pass it up the chain.
She sent the email to Bridget Kelly. Bridget Kelly responded, good, but then it ended. Then it died, and she never discussed that email with anybody
Bridget Kelly responded, good. I know Matt said this before, but he kind of ran over it pretty quickly. Bridget Kelly, when told about the traffic problems in Fort Lee and Mark Sokolich's concern about first responders not being able to get through in an emergency, she sent a one-word email back to Renna, good.
And if Renna didn't think that people were being punished or she was concerned or she felt that this was not something that Governor Christie's staff should be doing, she didn't take that information to anybody else. And that was sort of, you know, what she was talking about. And then when Bridget Kelly called her and told her to destroy it, she still didn't. And then when Bridget Kelly said, well, look, I had this email from Christina Renna on September 12th when she told Christie's top staff about it, they never questioned Christina Renna. I mean, it's just a remarkable, kind of unfathomable lack of curiosity by a whole bunch of former federal prosecutors.
And one more Renna clip from yesterday's testimony. She talked about Bridget Ann Kelly, who was her supervisor, after she got fired by Christie for sending the email, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, and Christie called her the architect of it. She called Renna in tears. And 12 seconds here of Renna's testimony about that.
She said a few times, I don't know what I'm going to do. And she apologized a lot. And then she said, you can't trust anyone, Christina.
Matt, you can't trust anyone, Christina. If she had done all this that we were just hearing about, including sending the email that said good and all of this, you know, apparently nefarious stuff. And then she got fired when she got caught. Who was she referring to when she said you can't trust anyone?
I mean, it is so tantalizing, isn't it? I mean, there the most obvious person that you would think of would be Bill Stepien. He was her the guy who she was in a personal relationship with. before this in the previous year, who used to be her boss and was the Christie campaign manager. He was also dismissed by Christie the same day that Kelly was fired. And it's and since she had answered to him for so many years, and since he was running the campaign in which this alleged political retaliation happened against the mayor of Fort Lee, you would automatically surmise that it could be him. Of course, though, there's no physical evidence that has yet come out indicating that Bill Stepien knew about this before it happened, let alone ordered it. And his lawyer has emphatically argued that he's totally innocent and shouldn't have even been fired by Christie. But I mean, he is the name you go to, and then I guess you can go up the chain up to the governor himself. Or maybe she's talking about herself. It could be a meta moment. I mean, it is one of the most fascinating lines in the 5,000 pages of interviews and emails that we have in this investigation.
We're getting an update on some of the Bridgegate and Port Authority related developments in the last day from our Matt Katz and Andrea Bernstein. Listeners, if you want to call in with any questions or editorial remarks, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And meanwhile, Andrea, back at the Port Authority, Governors Christie and Cuomo have taken the bold step of appointing a commission to look into it. What did they do together yesterday?
Well, they appointed each of their own appointees to the Port Authority, plus their own special counsels, both of whom are sort of very tied up in each of the governor's stuff right now. I mean, the Christie's counsel was involved in his own internal Bridgegate investigation. Cuomo's counsel was reported by the New York Times to have tried to quash some of the Moreland Commission, the former Moreland Commission's investigations into corruption in Albany. So that who is on this panel. There are no transportation experts. There are no academics. There are no think tanks. There are no heads of transportation systems from other jurisdictions. And they have set up this panel and has just 60 days to come back with a report to the governors. I mean, there's been this sort of enormous kind of round of kind of public agonizing over what has become of the Port Authority. Senator Charles Schumer gave a speech last week in which he was very direct of sort of basically saying that this has become a honeypot for governors. It's become the way that governors can run their own governments fiscally in a fiscally conservative way and then get more money that nobody's paying attention to.
And let me play part of that Schumer clip. And folks, Andrea reported a fabulous historical piece on the Port Authority yesterday. I can say that. She can't. You can hear it at WNYC.org. So go check this out. And you will get so much context about the evolution of the Port Authority as a honeypot, which was not how it was originally created. And here is and how it relates to Bridgegate as well. And here is Senator Schumer, who you called Johnny on the spot for hot topics of the day, and a little bit of Andrea's reporting around Schumer. Listen.
The proverbial honeypot, a cookie jar, a rainy day fund, whatever metaphor you prefer.
Senator Charles Schumer is always Johnny on the spot on the hot topics of the day. Last week, he gathered a bunch of mostly men in gray suits in a smallish room in Midtown to lecture them about the greater good.
The honeypot mentality has turned the Port Authority into a 50-50 operation between the two states. I get mine, you get yours.
That is, the two governors have been so busy diverting authority money to local projects that the bathrooms at the main terminal at LaGuardia Airport haven't been renovated in 30 years.
They mostly had gray suits. Nobody owns a blue suit, even.
It was a fairly monochromatic crowd in more ways than one. But that was, you know, who was in this room. And, you know, I mean, the thing is that, you know, Schumer, well, he was very careful to say, oh, well, I've worked so well with Governor Christie and Governor Cuomo. He's so wonderful. Actually did put his finger on the problem, which is that this has been seen as a giant pot of money that the governors can just grab. And Christie perfected that art. I mean, and that's what David Wildstein's job was. David Wildstein's job wasn't closing down access lanes to bridges. what his day job was, what he did most of the time at the Port Authority was get money for New Jersey, get money for New Jersey roads and bridges. Some of them operated by the port. Some of them have nothing to do with the Port Authority. The Pulaski Skyway is the most famous current example. Right. That's using the money that was supposed to go to a transit tunnel.
And so you have a clip of Christie in your piece that we have here. Do you want to set this up about New Jersey not getting its fair share?
Sure. So this was, you know, after all of this sort of browbeating and the Regional Plan Association held a conference and they did bring in the elders and even the Port Authority had a special committee meeting and they brought in a bunch of critics to talk to them and say to them how they should fix it. And I can talk more about that in a minute because I think there are some ways. But so they bring this in, and they've had all of this round of discussions, and then Christie is asked about the Pulaski Skyway, and essentially, no, that's what they believe in. They believe the Port Authority is there to help New Jersey, and this is what he says.
I've argued all along that New Jersey was not getting its fair share of money for appropriate New Jersey projects from the Port Authority.
By appropriate, he means
really important projects like the Pulaski Skyway, like Route 440, like the Whitpen Bridge.
None of those projects are owned or operated by the Port Authority, but the Port Authority's money relieved the New Jersey state transportation budget, which means Christie didn't have to raise the gas tax to pay for those really important projects.
Oh, come on. You think he would raise the gasoline tax under any circumstances?
No, well, that was the thing. He said, I'm not raising the gas tax under any circumstance. New Jersey has the 49th highest gas tax is number 49 in terms of its gas tax in the country. Only Wyoming has a lower gas tax. And at some point, and New Jersey also has the most roads per area of any state in the nation. So it has a lot of roads. And at some point, these things are not free. You have to pay for them. And, you know, I mean, former Governor Corzine left the Transportation Trust Fund empty because he didn't deal with that problem either. But then when they got there, I mean, that was Christie's solution is I'm going to get the money from the Port Authority and save my political tuchus.
And I guess you could make the case that it's not so bad if Port Authority money from this bi-state agency is used for worthy projects in each state that may not be officially bi-state, like the bridge or the tunnels that actually go between the two states, but for things like the Pulaski Skyway that contribute to a lot of interstate traffic. Of course, that goes to the Holland Tunnel. And so it's a major, major thoroughfare. If New York is also using Port Authority funds to do that same kind of thing, maybe not so bad, I could argue. But then the contrast in your piece is with, say, LaGuardia Airport, which actually is a Port Authority function and which has, mid-20th century ambience.
Yeah, I mean, it is going to get fixed. There is a project underway to address it. But I was recently in the San Francisco International Airport where they have this row of benches where you can plug in your laptop while you're waiting instead of regular airport seats. And they have zero waste so that everything you sort of throw out gets composted. And that is the environment that we are living in. And I think that, you know, you're lucky to get some sort of slightly lukewarm Chinese food at LaGuardia Airport. So, you know, that is the problem, is that the Port Authority doesn't have all the money in the world. That money actually doesn't grow on trees. And that at one point the Port Authority was incredibly rich because it had the tolls and it had the airport fees. But after a while, you can spend all that, and then somehow you have to come up with money for transportation infrastructure.
It's really funny, by the way, about those airports with the outlets in the waiting areas. I was just in the Miami airport about a month ago, and there was, there were a few of them in each area by a gate. And it was really hysterical to see human beings all gathered around this one pole and all the other seats being pretty much empty
right
in the waiting area. Oh, do people love those chargers? Okay, so Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Charles.
Hey, how are you? That's great.
So?
What I said before was I said that I think that the woman that testified really made a foundation for Kelly to go and liberate herself because really she worked underneath her. And it's obvious that there was someone else involved.
I assume by we, you mean the public, to get the truth out about what actually happened in Bridgegate. But Matt Katz, what about that? Do you think Christina Renna's testimony yesterday, the woman who worked for Bridget Ann Kelly and characterized her in various ways, paved a way for Kelly, who has taken the fifth so far, to come out and actually tell the truth and thereby let everybody know whatever Governor Christie's involvement himself may or may not have been in this?
Well, Kelly's lawyer first called Renna's testimony erroneous after it happened. So they've some separation there. But I guess if Kelly has some evidence that somebody ordered this, I mean, she would need to show the Fed some evidence so they could give her immunity for whatever her potential crimes could be, like destroying evidence. So if she has something that shows somebody ordered this and she could give it to the feds, then, you know, maybe she could make a deal. But I mean, I don't know if just saying, Chris Christie ordered this, told me to close the lanes. I don't know if that's going to be enough. She would have to have physical evidence, I think, for the feds to be able to make a case.
Well, a lot of prosecutors have a theory that that's why the Master Report worked so hard to discredit her and show her as emotional and unstable, and the implication is untrustworthy. Because if she is going to go testify to a grand jury or to a jury someday and say, I was told to do this, then they want to obviously try to create the foundation for us not to believe anything she's going to say.
Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, Brian. I was just thinking about the arc of history here, starting with the term that Schumer used, the honeypot mentality. Schumer was the one who replaced Senator Alphonse D'Amato, and his nickname was Senator Pothole. He's the one who promoted Governor Pataki as a candidate in 1994, and Governor Pataki is the one who began this process of turning the Port Authority from a long-term planning body into something that was kind of a pothole response patronage mill.
So thank you. And you go not just to Governor Pataki, whose name often comes up in that respect, but to the sponsor of Governor Pataki, D'Amato. You can trace it back as far as I guess you want. But, Andrea, we're almost out of time. Your piece goes back further than Pataki. And I did keep hearing Pataki is the one who started to politicize the Port Authority, and then New Jersey had to respond. But you go back to Mario Cuomo.
Right. That Mario Cuomo was the first one to sort of say, I'm going to use the Port Authority to bail me out. And it was a complicated financial transaction involving the Aqueduct racetrack. But this wasn't something that Republicans had a monopoly on or that New Jerseyans had a monopoly on. It's something and what was so extraordinary to me back in December when Pat Foy went before the New Jersey Legislative Committee and testified was that, you know, there's the official Port Authority Compact, and then there was the compact between the governors, which is we're not going to rat on each other because that might jeopardize our own spoils. The fact that it's all coming out in public, I actually think is a very healthy thing. And, you know, the board, to its credit, I mean, it's trying. They had a vote. First time they tried it, they took a vote, and then they were like, oh, wait, we forgot to have the debate. Okay, we have to rescind that vote. Now we're going to have our debate. Then we're going to vote. There actually was a public disagreement last month, which was unprecedented. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that this is an bi-state agency that's appropriating billions of dollars with literally no votes. But that was what was happening. No one was voting. So there is some of this stuff. And you know, there is a lot of scrutiny. And I think that is, you know, going to be I sort of think our paying attention to it is what's going to
maybe some good will come out of it. Now that the rot at the Port Authority on a deeper systemic level has been revealed because of the sensational Bridgegate scandal. So, Matt Katz, 10 seconds. New testimony coming after Christina Renna, additional testimony in the state legislature. When is that, next week?
Next week, we got Mike Druniak, and we also have some port officials coming up. Next month, we have Pat Foy, Governor Cuomo's top appointee at the Port Authority, so that should be interesting.
I know.
In the meantime, Christie's out campaigning in Maine for Republican governor there.
I know you'll keep us posted. WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, you can hear her fabulous history of the Port Authority being used as a honeypot at WNYC.org, and our Christie administration correspondent, Matt Katz, who you can see everywhere, all the networks on television all the time. Keep calling him up because nobody seems to know more about Bridgegate than he does. Matt, thanks a lot. Andrea, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the 5-mile-an-hour difference. Vision Zero activists up in Albany yesterday lobbying for a law that would reduce New York City's official speed limit to 20 miles an hour on local streets. Mayor de Blasio wants 25. What the 5-mile-an-hour difference means. Stay with us.